Hello and welcome to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are jingling your bells thanks to the brilliant OldFootballShirts.com. Do you know there's now over 96,000 shirts on display? That's incredible. Anyway, last Sunday, it saw most of us leave the MX slightly disappointed and wondering what might have been had we shown the same intensity in the first half in our defeat against Chelsea that we did in the second. Today, we head to Bournemouth, who we haven't beaten since Alex Ravel hit a hat-trick at Withdean in 2004. Be about time then, eh? And then on Boxing Day, we welcome Arsenal to the Amex and we hope to repeat last season's victory. However, with the travel chaos of having no public transport to the ground, let's hope that there'll be some people there to actually see it. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome a man who's been associated with the club in some form or other for over 50 years. He's done everything from making the tea to organising the buses to Gillingham, whilst also being the club's finance officer. He is also the secretary of the Albion Collectors and Historian Society. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Edward David. Hello, Ed.
Hello, AD. Good afternoon.
Hi, and it's absolutely a pleasure to have you here. We've tried to get you in here for quite some time, and boy, have you got some stories to tell.
Yes, I suppose sort of working for the Albion at least 21 years sort of in a capacity or another, I've certainly seen the rough and the smooth, as it were, and the history of the football club.
I mean, in that time, you've been in the lowest of the low and now the highest of the high, haven't you? I mean, that's as they say, the commonly used phrase, but we can't not say it, is the roller coaster.
It certainly was, actually, from the sort of dark days of the last season at the Goldstone to, of course, where we are now in what is the promised land, the Premier League.
Absolutely.
Now, Ed, of course, you are a raw virgin, as we like to introduce our newbies as.
Who, incidentally, I cannot let this pass, got lost on the way to the studio. Now, we've been using this studio here in Kemp Town, Hospital Radio Studio, for easily 2 years, haven't we? And it's not the easiest place to find. It doesn't advertise itself. But we like to give our guests good instructions as to where we are.
It's a hospital.
It's an NHS building. We're not in the county hospital. We're in one of the outbuildings on St George's Road.
I'd like to think we're in an operating theatre out.
Luckily, there's a bus that goes door to door from Falmer to the hospital. Ed got off the bus, Juliet County Hospital. And where did you end up after that, Ed?
And then
did you go for a swim?
Unfortunately, well, near enough. I actually went down the hill as opposed to crossing the road and turning right into Abbey Road. And then, so I actually lost my way somewhat.
You did, actually. Ended up down near the arena, didn't you?
I did. Well, not far off, actually.
Yeah, quite.
Right near the seafront.
But we are about to start recording the White Album, so
yeah,
that's
quite.
Okay.
Yes,
I mean, you've had a hell of an association with the club. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us about your Albion supporting history and how it all started for you?
Certainly. Well, my first visit to what was the Goldstone Ground, obviously, 1963.
Wow.
I was actually sort of at school at Lansing, and we used to get a number 9 bus to go along what was Upper Shoreham Road into Old Shoreham Road, get off at the bus stop by the opposite the North Stand, into the North Stand, and that was my sort of first visit to the Albion, 1963.
So you went, you grew up in Lansing.
Yeah.
Which school you were at?
I was at the college, Lansing College.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was there.
He looks like a posh boy,
doesn't he?
So it's you and Tony, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, Tony was a different house. I think he was in Olds. I was in Sanderson's.
Isn't it?
Well, I was quite lucky because we had a house master. His name was Ken Shearwood, and he actually played football for the combined Oxford and Cambridge Pegasus side of the early 50s.
Right.
They went on to win the Amateur Cup, etc. So obviously I was in the school team and obviously he let me go along to the Albion.
All right, so what level did you play that play?
Oh, no, it was only for the school.
Oh, right, okay.
So, yeah, it's nothing too serious.
So you jump on the bus.
Yeah.
And obviously this is before the bypass. So as you say, you take the route through Shoreham and then along what we know as Old Shoreham Road, what is now the 270.
Yeah, oh, I suppose it is, yes.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, it was the old number 9 bus, cross the level crossing where the trains used to run.
Yeah.
And then up Shoreham Road.
Hang on, used to run.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, there was a line in those days from Shoreham Station up through Stenning, Beeding to Horsham.
Oh, the Downs Link.
Or whatever they call slip road or whatever slip route or whatever it was.
Yeah. So all these days are black and white and it cost you one and six to get the bus or whatever it was.
Whatever it was.
So who were your first heroes?
Well, it was Brian Powney, obviously Bobby Smith, in the 64-65 Fourth Division Championship team would have been my heroes. From there on, so I was standing in the north stand then.
So you actually went straight into the north stand?
That's something that most
people actually move up.
It's a rite of passage, isn't it?
It's a rite of passage to start off at the east and move around the ground.
You didn't start the chicken run?
No. I did the north stand. Actually, the best view in those days was up by the pylon.
In the northeast corner?
Yes, in the northeast corner. Sure. That was a great view before the Oasis Awards.
That's quite, actually, I mean, in that northeast bit, it's actually quite a big terrace. I mean, if you can imagine, that if that terrace had not followed the contours of Goldstone Lane and carried on sort of level, if you see what I mean, across the top, that would have been a hell of a terrace. Not quite the same as Charlton's, maybe, but it's been a whopper of a terrace.
There and then eventually round to the chicken run, sat in the south stand and then the west stand. So I went all over the ground, basically.
You did the north, south, east and west.
Yes,
good man.
Yes, that's right. So done my dues.
So how did you end up first working for the club?
Well, first, about 4 years before the closure, because I knew Ron Pavey very well, and he said, well, would you look after what was the Tom Appleby suite on match days? The hospitality, one and only hospitality suite they had. And the sort of famous matches when, of course, there was Galzai and all those lads, etc. So that was quite good. And then, so it was that match days. And then, obviously, I got to know people like David Bellotti, and he asked me to sort of...
And you didn't murder him?
Well, no, I mean...
Okay.
I mean,
you're a good man, I
well,
appreciate that, yeah.
It's, it's difficult and everything else, so anyway, we'll get to that. I was working for a high street bank at the time, and then I was made redundant, and they asked me would I join 2 weeks later, and I joined the club in August 1997.
As a host?
As actually administration, finance... I mean, because you appreciate that there's probably only about half a dozen of us working for the club in North Road.
I mean, at that time, it can't have actually been a very nice atmosphere at all.
Well, no, I mean, we were actually living day to day, really, of course, because we were in Queen's Road.
Mm-hmm.
We moved around to North Road, and of course, in those days, we were then up Sticks to go to Gillingham for the 150-mile round trip. Which, it kept the club going, I would have thought.
I mean, during that time, obviously, we had Paul Stammer and the Articles of the Association and things like that going on. So, I mean, you must have been on the... You were working for the club at the time, so it must have been very, very difficult for you as a supporter, unlike Bellotti and Archer, who were interlopers, let's face
it. Sure, yes.
It must have been very, very difficult for you.
Most certainly, we were... we obviously had the interests of the club... And we're trying to run it as best we could, and all the folks, your good selves, Paul Samura, Falmer for campaign, was working hard, to find a solution and to get a brand new ground which we can call our own.
Absolutely.
So I say we were keeping the club together, so there would be a club to support.
Well, we'll come to that in a lot more detail later. But just there was just the name that you mentioned earlier there. Just for those, and I think you probably, I got a feeling I know who you're on about. But who was Tom Appleby?
Oh, sorry. Yes, he was vice chairman of the club. Mike Bamber was chairman. Director was Tom Appleby, but the vice chairman, of course, was Tony's grandfather, Harry Bloom.
Sure.
So he was he was one of the directors, vice chairman, etc.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and that was so we had a suite named after him at the Goldstone.
And that was the one piece of hospitality they had. The rest of the hospitality was mostly in Bellotti's face.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, but I mean, as well as working for the club, I mean, you've got a couple of other passions as well, which is A, following England around the world.
Yes, indeed.
And also... Mm-hmm.
A rival club in...
How do you have split loyalties, Edward?
Well, the...
With whom?
Chelsea Football Club. It's Chelsea. Because they hardly ever met since recently, obviously. Not only because my dad took me to Stamford Bridge because he knew an old player there and went to Stamford Bridge. And I suppose because they never met, it didn't clash at all.
Sure. Now, actually, as it transpires, one of the people I sit with in the West Stand Upper, he is also a Brighton and Chelsea fan. And I think he was a Chelsea fan first, but he's a Brighton and Chelsea fan. And I said, look, how can, you know, and his actual take on the Chelsea Brighton Chelsea game was, for me, there are no winners. Because even if Chelsea draw, that's no good for, and he said, us. And I said, but, you know, how do you square this today? And he said, well, when I first started supporting, and this raises Edward's point, we didn't play each other. This, for me, shouldn't be happening. In fact, stop the game. I don't want it to happen.
No, well, that's right. I mean, league-wise, I think we last part of the Premier League, we didn't meet to about 80...
83 was our first ever league game.
89, was it?
Yeah. 83, then 89, and that was it. Those only two seasons we played Chelsea.
I remember a game where Kerry Dixon scores.
That was 83.
Yeah.
And also, who was the left back? Chris Hutchins.
Yes.
Yeah. A couple of FA Cup games, and that was about it.
Chris Hutchins got done for provoking the crowd. And in between him getting done, him getting sort of prosecuted, for want of a better term, and it actually coming to court, in a logic which could only ever befit the Albion, he signed for us.
That's Chris Catlin for you.
Well, I mean, we actually bought a few Chelsea players. It was Gary Chivers, Keith Dublin, Doug Ruvie, of course. They all played for the old Blues.
Alexis Nicholas, Colin Pates.
Yes. Yeah, I think we're talking about this. Yeah, absolutely, anyway. Yes.
So, you know, they never met. And now, of course, it is difficult when you watch each other, the two teams play. I find it difficult to sort of really get involved in it.
I was doing another show a couple of weeks ago for another channel. Yeah. And one of the questions they were asking was about... Brighton Chelsea links and players who play for both. And the one that everyone seems to forget is Leon Knight.
That's the one. Well, that's the one we said, you know, you're welcome to Leon Knight's 21st. It was Leon Knight, ex-Chelsea, invites you to his 21st birthday party. That was it. Mm-hmm. This is what is a Brighton player.
I suppose this penalty did get us up a division.
Yes, it did. And, you know, we got the one good season in his entire career
That was a good old
day. We seem to be talking about Chelsea an awful lot, so why don't we talk about who did we play, though, on Sunday?
Let's talk about Brighton and Chelsea,
Strange that. Well, basically, there were some changes to the team. I think we're quite disappointed with this. Martin Montoya came in for Bruno, which was pretty much a no-brainer because obviously of who he's up against and needs a bit of
Alonso.
But also Stevens and Murray came in for Bruno and Bissouma and Doné. Now, this is a side which is Chris Hughton's put out on a regular basis. It's his first choice side. We're not going to argue with that. But when we've seen what... and Doné and Bissouma have actually been doing, and what it actually gives us against teams where we are going to need an outlet, it's a bit frustrating, really, isn't it?
If you take the front person first, Murray versus Andone, I mean, the criticism... I don't think anyone criticised Hughton too much for him picking Andone for the Burnley game, because I think just about everyone called that and wanted that, and then realised it wasn't his kind of game. It was more of a crash-bang-wallop game, and Murray was probably better suited to it. Fast forward to the Chelsea game, and you pick Murray because it's the first-choice player, and you realise that Andone would have been sort of, you know, because Murray and Gross, to be fair, were largely static. They weren't as busy and as mobile as it transpired. Bissouma and Andone ended up being.
But it wasn't until those two actually came on that there was any sort of energy.
That's my point.
Or sense of urgency.
That's my point. That's my point. And you think, okay, which then Hughton, I think probably. I mean, here we are telling a very experienced manager how to do this, but it's a case of Hughton picking and choosing which games. And it's not to say that Murray's done. Far from it. But it's a case of picking which ones that are right for Murray and which ones are right for Andone, because I think it's fair to say that Andone is certainly ready for us now.
Ed, I mean, how do you see it? I mean, have we seen the end of Murray as a first choice starter now?
I wouldn't mind seeing him possibly playing tomorrow at Bournemouth with Andone coming on. I think we certainly need some time to sort of get something tomorrow at Bournemouth, because then we've got the Arsenal and the Everton games coming up.
Absolutely. It's a tricky one. It's a case of working out how mobile the centre-backs in question are. I mean, if they're big bruisers, then a fast person in theory. you know, you think a fast person would be better against them, but, you know, Burnley...
Well, I still like to see. I mean, I'd like to see Murray play start alongside Andoni together.
Yeah.
With
do
maybe,
we know?
With maybe Gray's dropping to the bench, because it's a sort of the way that Murray and Bulldog work together. But obviously, Andoni's Bulldog version 2.0.
No, I think Andoni's an up. Say so it's certainly an upgrade. Yeah, so it certainly is an upgrade. But I don't think it can necessarily. It's hard to know that it's going to work that way. I mean, it sounds wonderful, but. Is Andoni a forward or is he a creative person? Because the person who plays alongside Murray, or just behind them rather, has been, in Houghton's mind, a more creative person rather than a finishing person. That's not to say they can't be both, and Gross certainly last season was. But to have two out-and-out strikers in a place where he wants an out-and-out striker and a provider, I'm not so sure. He has to tinker with the system again. In that instance, if it's an out-and-out striker and a provider he wants, I would so much rather see Bissouma, because Bissouma can also then double up as a third central midfielder should the occasion arise.
I mean, I think the main frustration stems from that one opportunity we had in the first half on Sunday where the ball... was passed out to Murray, who was in space and
he ended up
advancing
going
on goal,
himself.
And he ended up checking back rather than passing it. I think it was Knockhart.
No,
middle.
Absolutely.
There was two players in Knockhart. I think it was. I can't remember who the other one was. It might have been Stevens, actually.
Absolutely. Or no, I get that. I get the point. And we've seen him do that before. I think he did it last year against Arsenal. And it's slightly ridiculous. If you've got a team playing a high line, and this is where we actually did so well against Huddersfield, and it was Jared Evans who was sitting next to me, and he called it brilliantly. He said, you know, that Wagner has got Houghton's number in as much as he plays a high line and we don't have anything to work against it. Plays Andoni and he absolutely destroys them. So you get to realise that if it's a team that's going to play a high-ish line, then Andoni's the man to come on, because his pace... I know that Tompkins is a donkey, but he really showed him... He showed everyone, you know, what a set of afterburners he's got.
Absolutely. I think, yes, he's a very fast player. I'd like to see Bissouma start.
Yeah.
I think we all would.
But it's a case of Bissouma instead of whom. And we've seen the stuff come up. Is it Stevens or Stevens or Purper makes way for? No, for me, it's Gross.
Well, we did see all three of them at one point.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And that's when we played at our best. I've got to say, and it sounds like, I know he created the goal, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I know he created the goal, but Murray and Gross were so slow. They were so immobile. They were so static. They offered so little up front. And then Andoni and Bissouma, that's not to say they completely transformed, but you saw that everyone really woke up on the back of it.
Yeah.
When Nick Schipanek was on at the beginning of last season, and he was saying, what do we need? And he said, we need pace and guile. Mm. And Bissouma has a certain amount of pace. Andoni's got it in spades. And Murray and Gross, good as they are on the ball, don't have that. And I think we need to actually start exploiting that pace a bit more.
Okay, well, Chelsea did take the lead in this game. Now, we're going to have a debate about this, Eric, because
you're not. You're just going to have a rant.
The goal shouldn't have stood. The goal shouldn't have stood in my
You're asking view. A Chelsea fan this.
no comment on this. But, I mean, it's a shame that we didn't... this is Brighton, sorry. Didn't start as they started the second half. They should have started as fast as the first half. But it may well be that's how Chris's maybe gets to play, that they don't want to be sort of... goals against them are plenty.
Overrun, in
the first half maybe. But obviously we came good in the second half, Brighton, and could have snatched a draw, really.
Yeah,
absolutely. I didn't think that much of Chelsea, actually.
That's what I was talking about in the intro about the intensity of the first half.
Absolutely. And when you got Dale Stevens admitted, we gave them too much respect. Well, why on earth did you do that? If you can realise you can realise it afterwards. How come you don't realise it at the time?
We've already beaten Man United at home this season. We beat Arsenal at home.
To be fair, Chelsea ripped us apart, and there's the warning signs. I think people were more worried, for instance, this season about us playing Liverpool than they were about us playing Man United.
Yeah,
and let's face it, there is a modicum of confidence about us playing Arsenal. I think it's a bit unfounded, because Arsenal have clearly improved.
Yes.
However, you know, it's Chelsea tore us a new one last year.
Right.
Even though we should have had two penalties.
Okay, but this goal, that should it have...
Yes, I'm with you, mate. It shouldn't have done. I think that the ball was close enough. Who was the player offside?
Well, basically, he was involved...
Who was it?
He was involved in all of the cheaty things at Chelsea.
Oh, Alonso. What was he doing there?
didn't have a particularly good game, I didn't think.
Well, the referee helped him.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think he's got pictures of his mother or the ref's mother or something. I mean, I think there was various things that Alonso was doing during that game. But basically, you can call it gamesmanship, you can call it cheating, you can call it whatever you want. But during that goal, I mean, most people will be drawn to the fantastic skill of Hazard and the finish of Pedro. But Alonso was clearly offside in the middle, interfering with play, and he actually moved to block the run of Lewis Dunk, and he was right in the keeper's in the goal eye line.
Okay,
was part of the move.
The blocking of Lewis Dunk is always going to be a contentious thing, and you think you're not so sure. The offside bit has to be the call of the referee because it's linesman because it's an absolute rather than an opinion thing. You're offside, but. And I'm with you. I think the ball was close enough to Alonso. He didn't really swing at it, not in the same way that, for instance, Lukaku did for Man United, last week. But he didn't really swing at it. But I think it was within the eye line of Ryan enough. I'm not so sure about the blocking off, but let's suppose it did happen. I can see why it wasn't given. But
if he wasn't interfering with play, he should have carried on moving backwards. But he didn't get back onside. Well, and he was offside.
Yeah, I assume you're not accusing him of cheating because basically it was along the lines of Well, let's put it this way: he wanted to get there, and he probably had no idea whether he was offside or not. So, and even I thought
he did.
I'm not so sure, but.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, they did take the lead. And then a loose pass from Kovacic is picked up by March, who fires a shot goalwards, and it's easily saved by Azpilicueta. Any sort of elevation from Solly, and
we've seen him score like that. It was on target. I mean, we're back to what Glenn Murray said about Solly March. I think we've probably said it quite a bit on recent weeks, is that he is frustrating. He is either brilliant or he is maddening, and quite often nowhere in between.
And he was both on Sunday.
Yeah, he was either 0 or 11 and nowhere in between. I mean, at times he was absolutely brilliant, as he has been in recent games. And then there's other times, I mean, look at the corner at the end there. I know we'll come to it, but look at the corner at the end. Mm. Wow. Okay. Words fail me with that one.
Okay, well, Balogun underhit a pass, which he was doing quite a lot.
You say, yes, he does underhit them, and also he telegraphed it.
And it's intercepted by Willian, and who puts through Hazard, who races away and finishes with
aplomb. You have listened to the show, Ed.
And, well, yeah. He's
our second listener.
Wonderful player.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that... You would probably know this, that as soon as he was onto the ball, he was going to tuck it away, wasn't he?
Yep. Yeah, he is. World class.
Yeah. So, yes, not world class from Balogun.
Okay.
I quite like Balogun. I think he can be useful.
Yes, I mean, he's certainly there as a backup.
I think so, yes.
Absolutely. But, we're going to, again, come back to another point we raised last week, is, missing Shane Duffy. With his stupidity.
But I mean, to be fair, Shane's done that as well. I mean, it was early doors for him.
It's early doors for Balogun, absolutely.
And I think it was his debut actually when he played that back pass that it was.
Without betraying too many confidences, Ed, what's the word around the club about Duffy then? I mean, was there sort of like general unhappiness, or? And I'm saying this as people as fans rather than as staff
that's
members.
Right. I mean, yes. I mean, I thought, he is a Republican. Republic of Ireland international, and I would have thought possibly he could have pulled back and not get sent off, because we do need him and Dunk firing on all cylinders, as it were, defensively, because his defence is probably going to hopefully keep us in the Premier League and not do silly goals.
And also, as soon as he started scoring as well, which is a bonus from last year.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I've got here a question that says, how many times should Alonso have been booked?
Well, we know at least three.
Perhaps he should have had an early bath.
Well, to be honest, the first one, and Shearer raised this on Match of the Day, I think possibly the thing that saved him was the dramatic way in which Knockhart went down. Throws his arms up in the air. Yes, he bundled him a bit. I mean, people saying an elbow, I'm really not so sure about that. I'd have to look again. I'm really not sure. Yes, he knocked him off the ball. He sent him flying, but, you know, the really sort of silly trip, the petulant trip when Knockhart was, you know, running away in his own penalty area. The hilarious thing about it was it looked like such a blatant trip. Even though it's our area, the entire area around us went, penalty! So it was a really silly thing. Look, no one else listening to this on the radio is laughing. I don't care. It was funny. All right? But, yeah, that sort of thing with that level of petulance, a deliberate trip, that is an automatic yellow card. And as Shearer said on Match of the Day, he said he trotted past the referee expecting to card him. Now, this then begs the point, would he have then pulled back Solly March? Would he have actually taken his red card for the team if it meant that we have a free kick rather than, you know, the possibility of a certain goal, but a higher probability of one?
Well, the thing is, it would have been a one-match ban. Oh, actually, no.
No, it would be one, unless he's been sent off already.
Which would have... No, I think it has to be 7 days now.
Would no, it is been, a one-match.
Or would it have
been, and it can be the League Cup.
It would have been the League Cup game.
So, yeah, I mean, quite. It's like, what's his face? Who's the Leicester player that got sent off?
Madison.
Madison, thank you very much. He got a one-match ban, and that was a League Cup match. Yeah, so, yeah. So when they said, hang on, why is he... Well, it was the League Cup, so, yeah. Yes, he should have been sent off. I'm not so sure about the first one, but certainly the second
two. I mean, the one at the end, that was a straight red. I mean, Solly would have been... Straight, it would have been free. He would have made...
I'm not so sure he'd have picked up the ball directly in the path that he wanted to. I think he might... It was just that bit far ahead that I think it might have been driven a bit wide. The last defender is not the punishment. It's not the crime. It's denying a certain goal-scoring opportunity.
Which he did.
Yeah. Which he... No, because if by the time... Okay, bear with me here. By the time Solly March... Let's suppose he hadn't fouled him. By the time Solly March might have had to have gone wide to get the ball, Alonso might have been able to get back in place in order to get there. So, yes, it looks stupid, but the whole notion of the last defender is totally irrelevant. It's not the crime. It's about the...
A pedant, right?
Yes, all right. It's not the last man, and I'm not. And I think, as Chris Hughton said, there was enough doubt. If the ball, you know that March would have got it, then yes, it was a highly probable red card because. But I'm not convinced that March would have got it in the, you know.
I'm convinced he would have got it, and I'm convinced he would have missed. But I think he would have definitely got
it. Well, in that case, it's not denying a goal scoring opportunity then, is it?
Well, to be honest,
so you just argued against
the worst one to his own.
To be honest, everyone until they saw the replay afterwards was convinced it was Andoni anyway. So.
Well, there is that. I thought it was Andoni at first.
Okay, but Solly did actually score a goal.
Very good one.
It's all about that ball from proper, isn't it, really? Yeah. What a ball.
There seemed to be a moment in the game when a switch was flicked, and it might have been that particular moment because at that point, Proper started playing brilliantly, Stevens was switched on, all the rest of them were switched on, and we started really pushing, and the goal was kind of coming. So, yes, the little bit of work in midfield and that ball out wide over to Gross, absolutely fantastic. And you think, why couldn't we do this the rest of the game? It's so frustrating. It's like the switch was flicked and off we went.
A Brazilian Bernie's header wasn't very convincing in that.
I think it was the right thing to do. He wasn't going to be able to head it in. I love the fact he knocked whoever it was out of the way. You could see two of them going for it. Mm. And whatever Brazilian for mine is, sorry, Brazilian, sorry, whatever Portuguese for mine is. and I think it was just a case of then heading it back into the mix. And thankfully, Chelsea fell asleep.
And Solly put away. Yep. Okay, I mean, and we carried on doing it. And this, I mean, the pressure was coming and building and building. I mean, we obviously just talked about whether Solly was going to get the ball or not. But the ball that Bissouma put into that channel, we've been dying out for someone like that. And Murray wouldn't. If it was Murray, he wouldn't have made that. Mm. But I think Solly would have done it. And what a beautiful ball again. And you know, if that's the way we can play, that's the way we should be going forward. And I think that...
We can do it. And Chelsea weren't that much. You know, when we raised our game, I mean, the whole first half was walking pace because Chelsea didn't need to and we didn't know how to. But then when we raised our game, I assumed Chelsea were going to, and they didn't. You know, I mean, you've seen Chelsea. I mean,
no, that's right. I agree with you. No, it wasn't one of their better games. Obviously, Mayo's, I thought you'd save it for the League Cup, but that wasn't much better, actually. Yeah.
But I mean, we all knew the anyway. It was probably the worst refereeing performance we've seen at the Amex, certainly this season. Yeah. I mean, we kind of all knew that the writing was on the wall when he gave them a free kick for offside, which they took in a half. Well done.
Yeah, words fail me on that. It's okay. That was absolutely incredible.
Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are delighted to be brought to you in association with Phil Shelley's brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And I'm just going to pass this over to Ed. We've got a shirt of the week here. That is yellow, in case you're wondering.
Yes. So, Ed, could you describe that?
Short sleeve V-neck.
What colours?
Colours, yellow and white, presumably. Yeah. Clash.
There's a zigzag in between the yellow and white. There's a demarker. What colour is that? What colour are those sleeves?
They look like white, are they? White with black trimmings.
Okay.
Yeah, on the side.
It does look that. And that, what's that? What's the badge there? Can you see what's on it?
That just says Clash on it, is it?
It does say Clash.
That's the sponsor, but
that's the sponsor. I appreciate that. But it says Clash there as well, I think, on the actual badge, doesn't it?
Oh, right. So is this Joe Strummer FC?
It's not Joe Strummer FC.
Sure what Mr. Shelley's produced here, I'm afraid.
Any ideas as to which club that is? Or which country, even?
I'll be honest, no. this is one for Mr. Shelley's yellow and gold. It's not a Norwich one of some sort, is it?
No, it's not. No, Is it English? Okay, in light of your guest this week being something of a supporter of a London club, this is the worst I could come up with. London Calling. Well, not really. This is the 1996-97 home shirt of San Jose Clash.
In America?
MLS?
Yeah. MLS.
Who they played in the inaugural MLS season and, in fact, played their first ever MLS game against DC United, winning 1-0 with a goal by Eric Winelda. At the time, Nike were pushing all of their clubs to have eye-catching kits and equally memorable names. Right. Hence, Clash was chosen as the name for the San Jose franchise. The clubs were working on a shoestring budget, apparently, so anything could be done to capture the public's imagination.
Including making revolting shirts.
Yeah. Crowds were in excess of 30,000, and they watched the fledgling side in the early years, and players such as Richard Gough and Eddie Lewis, Leeds, Derby, Fulham, I don't know who Eddie Lewis is, they led the way. And in 2000, they changed their name to San Jose Earthquakes and promptly finished bottom of the Western MLS, which is the worst team in the entire MLS. Since they ditched the celery green, forest green, red and teal colours, they formed their original brand. They adopted an altogether nice combination of blue and white for the home kit. And a number of players known to us have turned out for the Earthquakes, including Junior Ogogo, Landon Donovan and Darren Huckabee. Do you remember him?
Norwich. So we've got some Norwich reference there. Phil, that is, sometimes Phil comes up with absolute beauty, but that is disgusting. It really is. It's interesting you use the word celery there, because I can't help it. I mean, I know it's the printout, but it does look like celery. I think that, Phil, for Christmas, you're sick, frankly. I love you very much, and I'm really grateful. We're both really grateful for the fact you sponsor this show, but sometimes you do make our eyes cry. You like that.
I've seen worse.
Yeah, but you hate the green shirt, so it shows what you
there's
know.
There's that American one that's got all the tassels on it. That's the
tassels.
Yeah.
No, that's the cheerleaders.
No, it's really not. Phil will dig it out. I'll dig it out later.
Actual tassels, not print of tassels.
Actual tassels.
Good grief.
We're absolutely delighted to have Edward David with us. Now, Ed, you've been, as we've mentioned, you've been working for the club for a very, very long time. So, I mean, we mentioned you about your
do you get a key to the door?
nothing like that. Okay. I did actually get a shirt when it was 10 years.
So presumably you didn't have any sort of relationship with the evil overlord of back then?
No, absolutely not, no. No, it was just sort of a job opportunity came up because obviously when we left the Goldstone, there was very few staff employed by the club at that time. Admin finance, with my finance background in banking, he asked, would I sort of do 3 days a week to start off with and then full-time about a year or so later.
So what do you remember about the early transition days of Archer finally ceding ground and Dick taking over?
Yeah, because I actually, John, when that happened, I mean, I didn't work at the Goldstone. So first days was actually in Queen's Road.
Okay. Was that above the shop or something?
No, the shop was actually further down the road.
It's been on both sides. Originally, it was on the clock tower side, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes, that's right. And then we moved across.
Okay, so where was the office then?
Well, the offices were in Queen's Road, Bright Elm
Centre.
Yeah, up there on the.
I know you mean community base.
That's it. Yeah, we were there top floor. There for a couple of years, and then we moved round to the ninth floor in North Road, which is just round
Tower
the corner
Point,
of the Tower Point,
etc.
And that's where we worked. I mean, in those days, our main problem was that obviously we did work there between 9 and 4, and then we had to up sticks, take all our stuff with us to go to Gillingham for a home game, which was obviously a 150-mile round trip.
Yeah.
And if it was a night game, well, we probably were lucky if we were back in Brighton by midnight.
Brilliant.
And then, of course, Saturdays. We were there for 2 seasons, as everybody knows.
Used to organise the coaches to Gillingham.
Yeah, well, the first season we did two coaches for the junior Seagulls to get them down there. And then the chief exec, general manager at the time, Nick Rowe, said, well, we ought to get all the season ticket holders down to Gillingham. And I said, well, the best way is probably by Brighton Hove Albion buses.
Mm. I like Brighton and Hove Albion buses.
Anyway, so we started off with sort of 6 double-decker buses plus supporters club coaches down to Gillingham.
Yep.
Which was quite interesting.
Absolutely. All taken off from what, Pool Valley, was it?
From Conway Street and Hove to start off
with.
Yes,
they did, yes.
Conway Street, Hove, and then Wish Road. There and then, obviously, there was the supporters, club coaches, Rambler, etc. A lot of them. About 10 coaches in all went down.
Sure. I mean, the logistics involved and all that must have been immense because, I mean, we're all on a shoestring budget at the time anyway.
Did they bribe the chairman or the chief executive of Brighton Hove Buses to get the buses dirt cheap or something? I mean, because, you know, I think we only paid £5 or something to get up to Gillingham.
That was for non-season ticket holders. Season ticket holders actually went for free.
Oh, okay.
But it was £5 and, they looked after us, Brighton Buses, in all fairness. Because obviously, it is Brighton Hove, so they want the club to at least survive.
Absolutely.
Getting down there, so that was just 2 years, and then obviously we were back up with Dean.
But what I was asking earlier about sort of like you know, in the early days of the administration stuff, so does this mean that you joined after the offices and what have you were actually set up in Queen's Road? I mean, were you actually part of setting the new Brighton Hove Albion up?
Well, I joined in the August, so the lights...
Dick officially took over on the 4th of September.
That's right. So I was in there just before they'd moved offices because the dear old Goldstone was... bulldozed around about the May time, I think it was May time. So we had June, July, they were setting up basic offices, really, in Queen's Road. And then I joined there.
Right.
And, you know, gradually got it built up.
I mean, was it well-run? Was it chaotic? Was it sparse? I mean, give us a flavour.
Yeah, it was sparse because, obviously, we didn't have the fan base in those days. I mean, we were probably but maybe 1,000 season ticket holders. Yeah. I mean, crowds were pretty poor anyway at Gillingham, about 3,000. So we did a lot by hand, mailing out that kind of stuff, mailing out the season tickets. Just generally running it as best we could. I mean, David Blotty did bits, and then obviously Dick came in with Martin Perry and Bob Pennick, who was the finance director.
And then we
started life from there.
So you must have had quite a lot of dealings with Bob then.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I mean, we had some money in the very early days, obviously, to sort of pay wages and bills, etc.
Oh, you paid wages?
Well, we did started off.
Okay.
don't forget, we had some money from the sale of the Goldstone, which we obviously used and to survive. We had the 2 years at Gillingham.
Mm.
And then Martin found with Dean, and We go from there, from within.
So tell us about the Bring Back the Albion campaign then, because I mean that took quite some doing. It took a long time to get organised, and the residents of Withdee weren't happy about it at all.
No, Falmouth for All campaign was fantastic with the supporters bringing us all back, and obviously the safety officer at the time obviously met with the Withdee residents. And, you know, we gradually build up a bit of trust. And, you know, we ended up at Withdee a long time.
Well, the thing is, not necessarily with their blessing, though. I mean, I think it was kind of, I would say forced, but it was voted through by the council, you know. And for a long time, the Withdee residents. So it's as much as there was a charm offensive by the Albion, you know, and actually quite a spiteful campaign by the Withdee residents back against us. You know, it's not as though that we immediately won them over, was it? I mean, was
no, it took some doing, obviously, because obviously we took a lot into place. We had the famous litter patrol.
Oh, the Wombles, yes. Led by?
Run by our dear Paul Welch, obviously. Yes. Bless him. So there was that. So we cleaned up. You know, there wasn't a great deal of parking, but maybe the residents sort of got used to car parking from the fans there, maybe. And, you know, gradually, I suppose at the beginning, we weren't supposed to be there that long, but obviously with the...
12 years.
12 years.
Yes, that's right.
Decoration said about three.
Took a wee bit longer to...
The Withdee residents, if they really didn't like us by the end, they could thank Lewis District Council for that. But I mean, you know, fast forward to 2011, and the most wonderful thing I do remember, and it sort of brings a lump to my throat now.
The old ladies.
Is the old dears with the. Oh, the old dears, sorry. Yeah, the old dears with the. what do you call it?
Goodbye.
Mural. Goodbye. You know, thank you so much, we'll miss you.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they did, because obviously. You know, they got used to seeing the crowds, and it was sort of enjoyment. And we had good, successful years there at Withdee, of course.
It was. I mean, basically, it was the biggest lifeboat in history. I mean,
absolutely.
It did keep us afloat for a very long time, which we're going to talk about.
In comparison, Gillingham was a tin can that you hung on to.
Yes, basically. That's right. But, I mean, you know, the whole experience there, and the whole, it was... I think it really forged a brand new Albion community,
and it concentrated the minds like you wouldn't believe.
You know, and there was people who were talking to each other. We could have been stood next to each other on the terraces at the Goldstone for years, and they are a nodding acquaintance. But all of a sudden, you're having conversations and cups of tea and chips.
Believe me, Albion fans know more about planning regulations than just about any other fans in the world.
Absolutely.
It's a joke we use on here often. And Withdee was the only place where you can get sunstroke and pleurisy at the same time. But it was a life raft, and the club had to try and stay afloat there. Now you were dealing in the financial side of that. So how bad was it?
Well, we were certainly.
Come on, be real. You know where the bodies are buried, so you can tell us.
No. It was difficult times, obviously. I mean, we had small crowds of you know, 6,000, and it was a question of sort of paying the bills as best we could, and obviously, you know, players' salaries as well. It helped that we had, I thought, some pretty decent managers, through the times.
On the pitch, we had a good time.
And I actually quite liked that team under Mickey. I thought it was an excellent team, to be honest. And, you know, it's got a good feel factor in the knowledge that we weren't going to be there a great deal. But so it was a struggle, but we eventually sort of got out of it.
Well, the thing is, I remember talking to you at the time, and probably sort of the mid-noughties, and it's I don't know if it's an apocryphal tale, so maybe you can confirm it, is that, to be fair, you always do come across as a little bit of a worrying type chap. Maybe it's the banking history within you. I don't know. But you had two...
On the side of caution.
That's the one, yes. Over on the side of caution. You and Chris Hughton. You got two...
You got like Will Sahar, who's got a face who was almost like he's like left the gas on.
Yes.
And then look at this jovial chap here.
Absolutely.
He's got a worrying face.
No, I suppose not.
I suppose that my tender age, you know, nothing's...
Until
so
sort of summers, you see his desk and he's got two trays, and one's the invoices due to go out, which is sort of like just barely reaches the top of the tray, and then you've got the invoices in, which are stacked about sort of, you know, yay high.
Well, I suppose that, yeah, you know, the
Dick,
more
how are we going to deal with this?
Oh, well, Dick, and eventually the money we kept was forthcoming, so
yes,
we
met
indeed. So, but yes, it was a struggle, and we had the sort of hospitality we helped a wee bit in the porter cabins. At,
well, you were a host, of course. So tell us about that.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. I mean, it was purely porter cabins. And in fact, the for memory serves me, the boardroom was a creche during the week,
I believe it was.
So that had to be converted to a boardroom on match days. Obviously, the porter cabins. And then I think the safety office was up sort of near trees, or you had to climb up to it. It was high up.
In a tree?
It wasn't far off, I don't think it was. It was
I think that's where security officers belong, frankly.
It was high up.
It was in that porter cabin just above the techie block.
Yeah.
I love the fact we've got, we had multi-story porter cabins anyway.
We did, yes, that's right.
Because the original hospitality one was kind of at the south entrance, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it moved further around the track, didn't it? That's right. It was because I think originally the away supporters were that end, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Well, and then there was the, I believe, was it the players' changing rooms?
Can you remember how many stands there were at Withdean?
Well, we had the kind of permanent one, which was sort of where the Withdean public house was.
Yep.
There's all those seats there. Then we had, to the left of it, a temporary stand.
That was the original away fans one, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right, it was. A small one where the disabled folk were.
And then the techie block as well.
Yes, and then the whole of the
police box was there.
South stand.
Then the whole of the south stand, and then the away end.
There were seven stands.
Oh, well, okay, fine.
Seven separate individual stands.
It acted as a stepping stone.
Okay, well, the planning process was going on and we were having the meetings at Hotown Hall and everything else, and you know, and Ed Bassford doing his bits, and Paul Sammer and Paul Welsh doing all their bits, and
everyone, to be honest, everyone doing their bit.
Eventually, we got the family. So you must have been delighted. Oh, that this is finally coming to an end, and then the rug got pulled out from underneath our feet again. How did you feel?
That was disappointing, because I thought, finally, we've got the go-ahead where we're obviously going to start building at Falmer. So it's another disappointer. But, you know, the club was sort of, it was still in existence, and we were still playing some good stuff, and the crowds were getting better at Withdean, and wasn't the sort of anti the club by the fans. Everybody was trying to muck in together. So it was community. Yes, that's right. It was, and you know, eventually we did get the yes. Thank goodness.
Did you ever attend any Falmer for All meetings?
I think I
remember those ones that were chaired by Paul Sammer, and then you'd have Ed and Roz puffing away in the corner, and Attila threatening to set fire to the pitch at Rochdale. Those meetings.
No, unfortunately not. No.
Dick always turned up late.
Well, I remember, I think Ed Bashford attended everything, didn't he? Every meeting?
Absolutely. I'm sure he did,
So eventually, you know, like everything else in this country, seems to take so long to get things done.
How much do you think that campaign actually cost?
I've no idea, to be honest.
Well, hang on, you had the books, mate.
No idea.
He does.
It's on public record, I'm sure.
I'm sure it is.
We'll go get Kieran Maguire to go through that.
Okay, well, Tony Bloom did come into the fray. And eventually we did move to Falmer. So, I mean, that was the whole
permanent roof over his head.
Yes, finally, you know, where the offices are. In fact, I've been in the same office all the time, which is behind the goal in the north stand. So it's fantastic. Coupled with, of course, getting into the Premiership, which is a completely different world financially and everything else.
Yeah, which we were talking about last week with Kieran, weren't we? Which was just amazing that we're actually. In profit for the first time.
But don't you also have rules about sort of what you can and can't wear when you're in the office?
We tend to try and wear Our suppliers brand on match days, yes.
Right.
Yeah, I think I said so wrong then, but it was like...
No, yeah. No,
where's
suppliers.
Where's this going, yeah?
No, yeah, we're supposed to, obviously. I mean, no. They do a good deal, as we all know.
So well, I can just see him sort of like, you know, trying to look like Lewis Dunk, yeah. You know.
But, I mean, it's an amazing story. I mean, it's just fascinating.
I don't think there's been a club like it. You know, where we were in 97, you know, bottom of the fourth division... Just about out and buried to where we are now.
But try and give us a brief overview over those 20 years of that sort of journey from bottom to top. I mean, from your point of view as an accountant and administrative person, but also how you view it in terms of the club as a whole and the way you see Dick and Tony and Martin and later Paul and what have you. How do you see your role within the incredible story?
Well, more sort of back up to them, financial wise, making things sort of tick, paying bills and everything as best we can. Obviously, the club has evolved from where we were. There's a lot more staff now, of course, with the training ground and everything else which has come in.
So, I'm just thinking in terms of the things that you've witnessed, the changes you've had, the not just the day-to-day stuff of money in, money out and things like that. I'm talking about the things that actually do sit outside the running of a football club, like the campaigning. I mean, you've witnessed it firsthand. Yeah. That's what I mean. Your role has been, whilst it's been a finance and administrator, it's been loads of other things too.
Well, obviously...
You have made the tea, apparently.
Made the tea, sort of do the bus journey. Yeah. I suppose it's the sheer volume of work that sort of, as each season has progressed, there's been more and more work, administration stuff. Certainly now, I mean, on the sort of football technical side, all the analysts and all that kind of stuff, which has come in from where we originally were at Goldstone. I mean, I started... In 97, there's probably only about half a dozen of us in the office.
Yeah.
We all met, and then sort of it's progressed to probably, 400 staff maybe?
Yeah.
Normal, and then the match day staff on top. So, and obviously coupled with us getting into the Premiership, so where life is a bit more rosy. That it used to be.
It's great. I mean, where we're at now, it's like coming from 97, quite nearly going out of existence to here we are, going into another year. I mean, it's just amazing. But it is Christmas time, boys and girls. It is Christmas time. So if Chris Hughton, he's sat there and he's got his fire on, he's got his slippers on, and he's sitting there and he's writing his letter to
Santa. Now he's a sextagenarian.
Yeah, and he's written the letter. He says, "Dear Santa, please can I have for Christmas, ... What does Chris want for Christmas? What does he want in the January window?
His players to start to believe in themselves a bit more.
That's what I found when we win.
Do you believe in Father Christmas?
I know, but I believe in our players.
Sorry. Going back to last season, I thought we suddenly realised we were Premiership when we beat West Ham. Away from home. That was suddenly we realised we are in the Premiership. We can hold our own.
But if he was, you know, if he's like looking through the catalogue and...
Are you talking about acquisition of players?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
I'm not so sure they're looking after anyone.
I think you've got to be looking. There will definitely be players going out, for sure.
Yeah, but there'll only be fringe players.
But they will need to be replaced because if anything... I mean, the likes of Schelotto, okay, he's not going to be seeing any game time anytime soon. Not Montoya.
Suttner, yeah, but we've got both those places covered. And you think it's ludicrous. Oh, not ludicrous, but to have three left-backs and the third of which isn't getting a sniff. He's not even getting onto the bench.
And we've got Dan Byrne to come in the summer.
We've got Dan Byrne, so that we need four centre-backs.
Do we want anybody then in January? Possibly not.
It's tricky tonight. Isn't it?
tricky.
I think it's Jurgen goes, which is possible.
Well, yes maybe. But then so. You know, then your darling Aaron Connolly can step up.
He's a different player again.
Well, of course he is. But the point is, I think it's actually. I think that we've got the quality there. I just wish they prove it a bit more often.
Yes. Yeah. They believe themselves that we can. I mean, we're 13th at the moment, so you know, there's no
it's
reason
not
why
too
we can't.
Shabby. Yeah, and we're still underperforming,
improving all the time, aren't we?
Absolutely.
So,
okay. Next week is our last show of 2018, and myself and Alan are going to welcome the band is getting back together for the last show of the year, and we'll be over the week. Look out on our social media channels because we're going to be asking you for the following. I'm going to be asking for your goal of 2018. Don't forget
Albion goal.
This is Albion goal, of course. Yeah. Don't forget this is the calendar year, not the season. Yep. But the calendar year. I'm going to asking for your moment of 2018, your game of 2018, and finally your player of 2018. So again, that's the calendar year, not the season. So has been your goal of 2018 so far? Obviously we've got a few more games before.
Well, we have, yes.
So far, yeah.
Well, I thought Solly's goal on Sunday was good. Performance, well, need we say any more than a couple of weeks ago when we beat our nearest and dearest, as it were? I would have thought that would be game of the season, or game of the year, maybe.
I think that might provide a moment, possibly.
I think I'm going to save my answers to next week's show. But I've got a few ideas. But yeah, the Palace game was superb.
It was superb,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But obviously, so just look out on follow us on Twitter, join our Facebook group. We're everywhere, pretty much.
Absolutely.
So just join in the conversation.
Absolutely.
And, so all that is left to say is thanks to everyone for listening again, and from myself and Al, a very, very Merry Christmas to what you want and all. And
if you're listening to us after Christmas, then we hope your hanger is not too shabby.
And jingly jing.
Hey, jingly jing. It's Dominic the donkey. Jingly jing. The Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. Santa's got a little friend, his name is Dominic, the cutest little donkey, you'll never see him kick. When Santa visits his paisans with Dominic, he'll be, because the reindeer cannot climb the hills of Italy. Hey, jingety-jing, it's Dominic the donkey, jingety-jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La, 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 la. La 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 de da. Jingle bells around his feet and presents on the sled. Hey, look at the Mayor's Derby on top of Dominic's head. A pair of shoes for Louis and a dress for Josephine. The label on the inside says they're made in Brooklyn. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. La 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 la. Children sing and clap their hands, and Dominic starts to dance. They talk Italian to him, and he even understands. Kumaras and kumbaras do they dance a darandel. When Santa Nicola comes to town and brings old Jucharil. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. La 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 de da.
Hey, Dominic, buona Natale. Eat on, 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 eat on.